Park Place Meeting, Saturday morning, 19th June, 1976. We have considered some of the presentations of the self, the meaning of self, in some of the religions of the world. Today, let us consider the Hindu-Buddhist presentation. First, we'll consider the Hindu presentation, which can be divided into two main aspects. The Supreme Self and the individual self. The Supreme in the sense of the total self. And here we have the great teaching embodied in the words Brahman and Atma. Two words to express one great reality. Brahman is a term which is all-inclusive. There is nothing excluded. Whatsoever man can realize, whatsoever can be realized through man, whatsoever is in the realm of the unmanifest, whatsoever is in the realm of the manifest, all that is included in the term Brahman, as one great unitary wholeness. This is the self, as they say. This term is an objective term. It is the answer, the ultimate answer, that man can give to the question, what is the whole reality? What is ultimate truth? The other word, Atma, is a subjective term. An Atma also stands for everything that Brahman stands for. And the great Upanishadic teachers declared unequivocally that Brahman and Atma are an identity. It's important to appreciate this point, that they are an identity, that they are one and the same absolutely. And the question arises, why two terms? As I've already said, Brahman is an objective term answering the question, what? Atma is a subjective term answering the question, who? Who am I? Is the question with which they started. And in the investigation of these questions, they started going outwards into the universe as the large, the immeasurable infinite. They went outwards and arrived at the term Brahman, answering the question, trying to answer the question, who? They went inwards into themselves and realized the infinite small, the point. It is a question of the difference between the boundless sphere, which is infinite, and the dimensionless point, which is the infinite in terms of the small. And they declared that they were an identity. Now, how is it that they arrived at the same conclusion? Both investigations take place in terms of the mind. In exploring the world in its largeness, one starts with sense observations first, and from those sense observations the mind draws certain conclusions. After a time, the mind comes to rest, the thought process comes to rest, and one enters deeper and deeper inner states in waking consciousness without falling asleep. In the ordinary way, if the mind comes to complete rest, the body generally falls asleep. In fact, it always does. But here one does not fall asleep, and one comes to rest, and the inner awareness intensifies constantly. It intensifies. One is awake in a manner which is quite different from the awakenedness which we know so well in our bodily state, when the body is awake and hasn't gone to sleep. So that one comes finally to a point where there is a complete cessation of everything describable, everything that can be conceived of or felt by the mind. Now the same thing happens when one goes inwards, asking the question, what am I? Dealing with the who. One starts going inwards analytically, and one realizes the nature of the psyche, the nature of the mind and its processes, and in this inward going one reaches a point where one joins the road when one explored the nature of the world going outwardly. So you start from two different positions in each case. And before long, the two have become a single road. The mind has come to rest. And the innermost state realized in each case is the identical condition. So, this objective road, the subjective road, lead to the same point ultimately. But because one started with the subjective road, the name given to that end point was Atma. There is also another aspect to it. The objective realization involves an externalization of the search. The subjective approach is an internalization. Before long, the external and the internal as distinctive roads vanish, and there is only realization taking place. Therefore, the utter indivisibility of the individual and the totality is realized as a fact. This is one of the deep origins, the roots of what is sometimes called pantheism. It is all just one thing. It is all just one spirit, one supreme ultimate creative energy. If we are confined to an intellectual perception only, innumerable questions will arise, some of which may be answerable satisfactorily, and others will not be answerable. But if the realization is a realization in terms of consciousness itself, then no such questions arise. In awareness, the unity is complete. So, it was also taught that the individual self, the jivatma, as they called it, the individual self is a microcosm. The all-inclusive total self is a macrocosm. But the microcosm and macrocosm are not two separate realities. The one completely expresses the other. This is, of course, very difficult for the brain to grasp in the ordinary way. For the very simple reason that we, as we function here in ordinary everyday consciousness, are so aware of space and time, of measurable distances, sizes, volumes, and so on, that it is quite impossible to visualize how one individual this size is the receptacle for the total universe that size. It is quite impossible. One says this is quite illogical and absurd. Here, it may be helpful to bear in mind this fact. That in terms of that, in our exploration of the large whole, as well as our exploration of the small whole, the individual, it is a matter of the manner in which we are conscious. Now, the manner in which we are conscious is under the domination of the nature of our own mind and the way it functions. Our own mind, in the ordinary way, functions in terms of measurement because we are conscious in terms of finite objects. What is space for us? What is a distance for us? A measure which we arbitrarily impose, which separates two finite objects. If we were not conscious, because of the manner in which we perceive things, of two finite objects which appear separate from us, there would be no such thing as distance for us. Now, when the activity of the mind in this manner comes to rest and one is awake, the mind functions in that other manner in which separation between two finite objects disappears. There is no distance between that and this. The separation and the cognition of finite objects is due to the fact that the body, the living body, has these different senses, and it has a brain which functions analytically, it functions as a computer, and it functions as a mechanical synthesizer, making patterns. Now, the patterns come into being because of the existence of separativeness. If there were no separativeness, it becomes an all-one. So if we bear these facts in mind, we shall see how, when the ordinary thought processes, the analytical or mechanically synthesizing thought processes, come to rest, one becomes aware in terms of a unitary wholeness. And this awareness in terms of unitary wholeness has its degrees of intensity. It is the degrees of intensity which we call the deeper, or the not so deep states of awareness. And in this ultimate intensity possible, there all feeling and perception, not only in the ordinary everyday sense, but in the transcendental sense also disappears. You might say, but this is sheer unconsciousness. What difference is there between this? What difference is there between this and annihilation? It is not annihilation. The difference is just here, that this is realized whilst one is awake. The body hasn't gone off to sleep. You are awake. This state is also realized when the body falls asleep. In the really deep, profound slumber, one is aware in this state. But when one wakes out of bodily sleep, one is unable to bring through into one's ordinary everyday life in the awakened state the impress of that transcendental condition. Whereas when it is realized in meditation, in the true deep communion where the body is awake, then the impress of that state comes through in its purity right into the psychophysical organism when awake. And this produces an incalculable difference in the waking life of the perfected Holy One from the life of the one who hasn't realized that condition. This process of inward going is a process in which the mind, as we ordinarily know it and as functions in us, is completely eaten up, so to say. It is eaten up. That is one of the reasons why the term Atma is used, from the root at meaning to eat up. And the Atma is called the eater up of the mind. Because the mind as it functions in us is the differentiator, is that which splits up the reality as it is in its wholeness, in its original condition. It is the instrument which makes images of the reality in our waking state. Our image-making faculty, imagination, sets up a picture of the cosmos within us. Whereas, when the mind has come to rest, pure rest, the mind, our mind as we call it, makes no pictures. Our pictures are always distorted. It is like seeing through colored glasses. Because the activity and the functioning of our own mind, as it is conditioned from the moment we are born. And so, it is that conditioning which colors every impress upon us. If we understand this, we will see how and why the discipline of the religion is what it is. This process of purification, this process of being awake to totality through the use of the senses, whose functioning has become freed from the limitations imposed by the conditioning of our minds. It's not very easy to absorb, for the intellect to absorb the full significance and the implications of all this. This purification starts with the ordinary virtue-vice problem. What is a vice? When our own psychical energy functions in a manner which brings illness to the body and to itself, then that is a vice. Anger, hate, jealousy, and so forth, all these things we call vices. When the psyche functions in a manner that does not bring about this ill state, we call it a virtue. In addition to that, this is the moral aspect. In addition to that, there is the purification of the intellect. Now, this is very, very subtle, very deep, and very difficult to get at. In the main, the intellect is subject to bias, to prejudice, to preconception, and to assumption. These are the blockages as far as the intellect is concerned. All of these distort our perception of the true nature of things as they are. Things as they are make their impress upon us all the time. The mind interprets this impress, makes a pattern out of the impressions received, mechanically synthesizes them. But in the act of this synthesizing, what we call grasping with the mind or understanding with the mind. In this process, our biases, prejudices, preconceptions and assumptions distort that which we are perceiving. And we know very well in the ordinary way that two people who witness an event will almost never give an identical description of the whole event. They can't. If in a court of law one person swears that he saw this, that and the other happen, another person, another witness giving evidence may say, yes, so and so, which the other man said is true, but he saw something which the other man didn't see, or something like that. The description is always different, because our conditioning is different in each case. So now, this is one of the very difficult aspects involved in the purification of the mind, the intellectual aspect of it. And this intellectual aspect in all of us is very much in thrall to our desire drives. We perceive very considerably what we desire to perceive. This is a very subtle working of the mind. If we can begin to understand this, we will understand, we will appreciate why complete desirelessness, utter desirelessness, has been so strongly emphasized in Hindu Buddhist teachings. What we call evil desires, well, everybody has sense enough to know that, well, that is evil and we must be free of that. But the good desires, what we call the good desires, are we to be free of those also? Yes. Be free of the good desires too. Because a desire is a particularized formulation through the activity of the brain of that which is a universal urge or force at play. And it gets twisted by the individual to take on a particular form. And in that, and because of that particularization, because of its finite nature, it tends to twist, to distort the infinite. And so one is not awake in the full sense of the word awake. When one is fully awake, there are no desires whatsoever to hinder the mind from functioning as the perfect, unresisting instrument of pure intelligence. This is very, very difficult even to begin to see. We think we see it. For at least 30 or 40 years, this aspect of things, of the whole life of the religion, I have tried to understand. And after all these years, I'm only at the point where I dare not say more than that I've just begun to make the top of the curve of the letter A. As you grow, as you progress, such immense vistas open up. One sees the immensity of what has to be done. And at first, it frightens one. You are, one gets depressed. One feels, oh, but this is impossible to do. Yes, of course, it is impossible to do, because I have the desire to do. Which brings us to the crux of the matter. All desire is self-oriented. And our whole task is to realize freedom from the limitation of individual self in awareness, mind you. It can't be done in body, of course. In awareness, the freeing of being limited to the individual self and being one, an integral part and parcel in awareness with the total self, the macrocosm. As and when that liberation can be realized, the complete freedom from all desire, the other freedoms soon appear. The freedom from bias, from prejudice, from preconceiving, and from assuming. All these are activities of the individual mind. The totality, the ultimate reality, God or Brahman or whatever word you like, which is associated with mind as such, has no such limitation. How can totality have a bias? A leaning. A leaning is a particularization. How can, to what can totality lean? How can totality have a prejudice? How can it preconceive, have a fixation? Or how can it make an assumption? What assumption can totality make? We make all these things happen in us in terms of something finite in relation to another finite, or in relation, if you like, to a sense of the infinite. But it is always something finite in relation to something other than. The sense of otherness at last disappears. When the sense of otherness disappears, then this utter purification has taken place and one is truly awake. So you see, the importance of desirelessness in this process of purification, one of the supreme disciplines of the religion. The question will be asked, but if I lose all my desire, I'll lose all my drive in the world, I shall just be like a cabbage or a block. May it be suggested, first, try and realize the state of desirelessness. Then you'll know for yourself, without my saying anything about it, whether you'll become like a block whether you lose your drive or whether you will be active, sensibly active, fruitfully active, wholly and totally active, in the true sense of the word active. See, there are all those questions which we ask in our imperfect state. Of all those questions, some are questions which we may legitimately ask, because insofar as they come within the sphere of a particular context, then they are applicable to us here and now, and we can have sensible answers, constructive answers, and so forth. But other questions whose context needs that we should enter the immeasurable are questions we just mustn't be asked. We must wait and see. We must experiment. We must practice the religious life and see what happens. And then you'll find that the question just vanishes. If we ask questions of a nature which are self-oriented, we cannot try to discover that which is infinite in terms of self-orientedness. There are two different contexts. The total context includes all the little contexts. And it is through the little contexts, it is through the separate self, as we call it, that the supreme self can be realized by man. Otherwise, there is no means of realization. Something like this is the basic ground which, if we begin to understand it intellectually, of course, at first, is the basic ground which will indicate to each one of us, as we are, the nature of our self-discipline. Whilst there are certain general principles which we can lay down, which we can talk about, the actual details of those principles, you know, being truthful, being pure and all the rest of it, the details are a matter for the individual, because they concern him and him only. And because all of us are different from each other, there will be ever such slight variations. It is for us to find all that out. Now there comes the other aspect, another aspect. And here, the Buddhist teaching assumes great importance. The Buddha's analysis of the finite, temporal person who is alive in space and time, here and now. What is the person composed of? Very broadly, what we call body and what we call mind. And you will notice that they do not talk in terms of body and mind as two separate things always. They always use the hyphenated nama rupa, mind body. Our English term psychophysical is, as far as I'm aware, a very accurate equivalent to nama rupa. We are psychophysical organisms. Now, there are certain differences which we should appreciate, because that makes things easier for us to understand the Buddhist teaching. When we say body, where we say body, meaning this obvious object called the living body, which has a definite size, a definite constitution as such, the term rupa has a much wider meaning. It simply is form, shape. When we say mind, we rarely feel it out as thought shapes or thought forms, as mental shapes or mental forms, mind shapes or mind forms. But rupa is a word which includes this solid body shape and form, as well as mind shape and form. The term rupa is not confined just to the physical body. It is any shape and form. Now, it's very important to realize this, because you will find that the Buddhist analysis proceeds further in this manner. Having said rupa, then under nama, you get four aspects presented. What they call vedana, feeling, which would include, I think, what we call sensation, bodily sensation, as well as emotions, as well as thoughts. Thought processes are a kind of feeling out. Then they talk of sanya, thoughts, ideas, perceptions as such. Then they talk of sankhara, the thought patterns, the complexes, the mind complexes that we have, and so forth. And then vijnana, specifically meaning discriminative consciousness. Please note that. Discriminative, therefore the divider, the separator. You can't discriminate unless you separate. Now, the whole of the Buddhist discipline is directed fundamentally to the nama part, the psyche. Why? Because the psyche in man and the mind in man, as manifested in man, by contrast with what a mind is manifested, mind as it is manifested in animals too. The mind in man is something which differentiates him completely from all the rest or from all other living creatures. Mind dominates our whole life and our whole development. And our whole development, not only in the religious context, but also in the worldly context, has mind as has mind playing the dominant part. You have to think a thing out, you've got to feel, and so forth. Without thought, without knowledge, without feeling, what can you do? Just be supine, more or less. So the whole of the discipline is directed towards the discipline of the mind. The training of the mind, the understanding of the mind, and what we commonly call the controlling of the mind. Now, all the discipline of the mind consists in this process of freeing it from all its defilements, from all its incapacities. And you will notice that the starting point is with the training of the senses. The senses are the indispensable media for our everyday existence, for our realization of our destiny and for fulfilling the purpose of our existence. Consider very briefly how we use our own minds. How we use our senses. When we look at something, just how accurately do we see the particular object or the person? Is our percept, which is our living experiencing in the immediate now, note carefully, living experiencing in the immediate now, that's the percept, at this moment, is the percept whole and complete? Again, take the instance of any two people looking at the same object. And the descriptions given by the two will be very different. They may perhaps be slightly different if the two persons are very much alike in development and ability. But if they are not, then their descriptions will be very, very different. So that the perceiving, the living perceiving in the immediate now by this person is so different from the living perceiving in the immediate now by that person. Now this is how we all use our senses. Imperfectly, incompletely. And a large part of that incompleteness and imperfection is due to our ordinary conditioning, which makes us interpret in a distorted, in an inadequate manner, and by our desires. We wish to see something, we don't wish to see the other thing. I am at loggerheads with John Brown. When I see him turn the corner, I don't want to see him. But somebody else who is not at loggerheads with John Brown will certainly see him, and really his whole attention will go out and he'll see all about him, so to say, or try to see all about him. See, we use all our senses in this manner. You know our good old phrase, oh, I don't want to know anything about it, I don't want to hear anything about it. When we hear something which is against our desire or is antagonistic to our particular conditioning. So we don't use our senses properly. We are not sensible. Inherently in us, we have an extraordinary power of sensitivity. Extraordinary sensitivity. Now, how can that sensitivity, right down at the physical level, come to fruition so that we are truly human creatures looking, listening, as contrasted with, say, animals looking, listening? So, the training consists in letting the eyes see. And in being fully aware of all the reactions that immediately spring up in the mind in the act of seeing. Because those reactions will show us how the mind is conditioned and how our particular self-oriented desire is working. So we come to know ourselves in the act of looking. This is the beginning only of knowing ourselves. And the same with all the other senses. And in this basic practice of looking and seeing, of seeing, of hearing, of touching, etc., mindfully, in this basic practice, an extraordinary transformation and purification is going on of the whole psyche all the time. And something else happens. The barriers between the person or the thing which is seen or heard by us, the barriers between that and ourselves dissolve away. When you see truly, when you listen truly, and these barriers dissolve, the sense of isolativeness disappears. And when that isolativeness disappears, the state of love, of right relationship, springs into active being, it comes into its own. And it functions naturally, unsentimentally, unemotionally, but it functions efficiently, perfectly. It loses its definition, meaning its limitation. It becomes universal. Now you know the meaning of love by being love, because this is how your whole being is actually functioning, in right relationship. And so the hidden sensitivities within you awaken. They have free expression now. This is just the beginning of the discipline. And when all the senses are like this, then you will discover that the senses are indeed the living cords of communion between the microcosm, which is oneself, and the macrocosm, which is the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade in its essence, which is Brahman, which is God, which is the Supreme. In this is your true happiness and your true health, your true wholeness.